1 Kings chapter 13. As we go through this study of 1 and 2 Kings, we get to this section. There's some big things happened while I was gone, right? What happened in Kings while I was gone that you guys talked about? What's that? Solomon, you know, yeah, all good things must come to an end, right? So Solomon kind of fumbled some things there at the end, didn't he? How about a son? How is he with his PR skills? Rehoboam, not good on his PR skills, right? He had a chance there to save it, to pull out of the nosedive, and what did he say? No, let's go down faster, right? So, no, he split the nation. Jeroboam being the opportunist that he was. And Jeroboam being this kind of weaselly guy, what did he do in order for the split to remain? What did he do so that the people would not go back, their hearts would not go back to Jerusalem? What did he do? He set up... Yes, to the altars. He set up Dan and Bethel's like, hey, you know what? We're going to make this easy for you. We're going to set up these altars here and have priests here, and it'll be just like good old times. Did God think it was good? No, it was not good. And we'll talk more about that in the rest of this book. So chapter 13, we start off with the man of God from Judah. Chapter 13, this prophet is sent from Judah to Jeroboam to give him a message concerning these altars that he'd set up, concerning this system, this false system, that kind of looked like the old system, in that it had priests and that, you know, they had some, but it wasn't altogether like the old. It's close enough. Does that work? Is it close enough work? Not quite. God's like, no. How about no on close enough? What's that? That's right. Yeah, drive-through priests. Anybody, basically, at one point, you're saying anybody that shows up with some offerings could have been a priest if they wanted to. So it was no big deal to be a priest. So this man of God from Judah is sent to Bethel. So Bethel is the center of worship in the southernmost point of Israel, and he's sent from Judah from Judah up to Bethel, which is about 12 miles. Or at least from Jerusalem to Bethel is about 12 miles, and he's sent up there. And he is sent, and he goes, while Jeroboam was standing at the altar to burn incense, he cried against the altar by the word of the Lord and said, O altar, altar, thus says the Lord, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by name, and on you he shall sacrifice the priests of the high places who burn incense on you, and human bones shall be burned on you. So Jeroboam's up there doing his thing, you know, whatever he's doing to worship, and this prophet comes and begins to cry against. So it's not like Jeroboam was there by himself. There's a crowd. He had to push his way through the crowd to get up there to say these things, right? And he cries against the altar. And then he gave a sign that it was going to happen. The sign which the Lord has spoken, behold, the altar shall be split apart, and the ashes which are on it shall be poured out. Now, how does the king respond? Thanks very much for your message. We validate parking. How did he respond? He's like, reaches out to grab him, to be command to be seized, and what happens to his arm? Yes, it's sort of like, it just kind of stays out there, and, you know, I don't know if it looks like the arm from, you know, the Crypt Keeper, or what happened exactly. But it's out there, and he couldn't draw it back to himself. So it raises some alarm that his arm is no longer useful. And the king said to the man of God, please entreat the Lord your God and pray for me that my hand may be restored to me. What phrase in there is a little telltale about Jeroboam's heart? The Lord your God. Which is to say, he's what? Not mine. That's not good, Jeroboam. And so this is what happens. He does get his arm back. He goes his own way. Jeroboam's like, hey, why don't you hang out with us for a little bit and have something to eat? And the man of God from Judah says what in response to staying with him, hanging out and eating? He's like, nope, can't do that. Why did he say he couldn't do it? What does the text say? God told him, said, I can't do that. I cannot eat anything. I can't linger here. I can't eat anything from you. I got to go back. A 12-mile hike at the least, right? Before you can get across, well, maybe not. You can get across the border maybe and start eating and drinking or doing something there. But he couldn't eat or drink or anything while he was there. So it wasn't supposed to be a long-term visit. So he's supposed to go back. And so then enter, so there's this man, the man of God from Judah. And then verse 11 we have introduced, enter stage left. What character in verse 11? The old prophet living in Bethel. Which, by the way, there are some religious people who are still, you know, on the team God and want to worship the way they're supposed to worship had already left. There had been an exodus whenever he had started up some of this, some of these things. But this prophet, for whatever reason, decided to stay in Bethel. And the sons came and told him all the things that happened about the man of God. And they asked him which way did he go, because he couldn't go back the same way he came. He had to go back a different way. And so he asks about him, and he goes to try and intercept him. And so he saddles his donkey, and he goes to intercept him. Now, there's some discussion about why this guy tries to intercept him. Because he intercepts them, and what does he do when he finds them, which he finds this prophet sitting under a tree, which if you're not drinking or eating or anything like that, you might be a little peaked or something if you're traveling. And so he's sitting under a tree, and this guy finally finds him. And what does he say to him? Hey, come eat with me. And he does the whole thing, well, I can't do that. And God told me, I said I couldn't. But the old prophet says what? Oh, you know what? This angel, yeah, I meant to tell you right away. This angel said that you could eat. So it's like it's totally kosher now. You can come back and eat, and it's fine. And he should have known that God had given him a message that nobody else should change it, right? If you want to write out there side the Galatians 1, kind of Paul deals with that same kind of concept, that once God's given a message, he's not going to come back and then like, oh, you can, well, we'll change it. We'll change that message. So he tricks this man, convinces him to go back. And as he's eating whatever he's eating, God talks to this man of God from Judah and tells him what? Verse 21. You are going to die, basically. You didn't listen. You didn't do what I told you to do. Your body will not make it back to be buried with your fathers. So what happens? He gets on a donkey, which may be the guy now feeling guilty that, oh, that it was legitimate. So there's some debate about whether or not why this man, this old prophet, would have done that. One discussion is that possibly he did this because he wanted to verify for sure that this guy really was from God. That this guy, his message really was indeed from God. Even though there was a sign that was fulfilled, even though Jeroboam's hand was withered then unwithered, he needed one more sign. And maybe if this happened, he was verifying his information about eating there in that land. So, but other than that, we don't know why he did this. But he gives him a donkey and he goes. And on his way back, he's attacked by a lion. The lion kills him and is sort of just left on the wayside. The Bible talks about him not anymore as his body, but his carcass, like it's just some piece of trash on the side of the road. There's no real concern for the body at this point. And the lion and the donkey just sit there kind of looking at him like, yeah, I did that. There was there in the text, as you read it, the text even says that the lion didn't tear the body, didn't try and attack the donkey. It just kind of was chilling there with the donkey for a while until the old prophet shows up, takes the body, and actually has the body put in his tomb. And the instructions that he's given to a son, he tells his sons at the end of this chapter, they mourn for his body, or they mourn for this man. And then verse 31, after he had buried him, he spoke to his son, saying, when I die, bury me in the grave in which the man of God is buried. Lay my bones beside his bones, for the thing shall surely come to pass, which he cried by the word of the Lord against the altar of Bethel and against all the house of the high places which are in the cities of Samaria. So two things. This was actually remembered. In 2 Kings chapter 23, verse 17, they still remember this prophet. They still remember this place where he's buried. And so they still remember this event. And Samaria actually doesn't even exist yet. But he kind of mentions sort of this event as though people who are reading this text understand the area of Samaria and know about Samaria, because Omri is a king that sets up or builds Samaria. So it's not even a place yet. But the people who are reading this text know about it. And so they're using it as a regional focus point. So this message with the prophet from Judah in chapter 13. And then chapter 14, Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, became sick. So Jeroboam does not turn from the evil. And then we had this prophecy against Jeroboam and against his son. So his son becomes sick. And what does Jeroboam say that he needs to do? Take 10 loaves with you. And he tells his wife to do what, basically? We have some cloak and dagger things going on here. Hey, disguise yourself, travel down to Shiloh, and consult whom? Ahijah the prophet is there, who spoke concerning. Go down and talk to him, okay? This is the guy that had talked to him before, had spoken to him about being commander of these people or being king of these people in the north. And so, hey, go talk to this guy. And so he's sent down, which, by the way, Shiloh is about 30 miles. So this was an overnight journey for her to go down and do this, to carry these things with her. And, you know, trying to be secretive about who she is. Can you trick a prophet of God? It usually doesn't happen. It usually doesn't happen. Except for when you lie to him about angels. Other than that, it doesn't happen. You can't trick a prophet of God. And so here in this situation, he is blind. He can't see, but the Lord tells him who it is that's coming. And as soon as she comes in, he kind of just tells him, hey, I know who you are. He says, behold, the wife of Jeroboam is coming to inquire. And so he knows about what's going on. Verse 6, when Ahijah heard of her feet coming in the doorway, come in, wife of Jeroboam, why do you pretend to be another woman? So he has this harsh message for her. And he says, because I exalted you from among the people and made you leader over my people Israel and tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, yet you have not been like my servant David. David becomes a sort of litmus test for kings. After David, everybody's kind of compared to David as a litmus test as to how to be a king. Did he mess up? Yes. We're even going to read that where it kind of they mention his mess up, but he's still, other than that, he's still kind of this litmus test for kings. And he didn't do this thing because David kept his commandments and he did not. David followed him with his whole heart and Jeroboam did not. He says, you've made these molten images to provoke my anger and have cast me behind your back. You have cast me behind your back. You've disregarded me as an authoritative figure and you've put me behind you and placed yourself in front of me. And so you see the imagery that's there. It says, therefore, I'm bringing a calamity on the house of Jeroboam. I'll cut off Jeroboam, every male person, both bond and free in Israel, and I will make a clean sweep of the house of Jeroboam as one sweeps away dung until it's gone. That's kind of pretty graphic, right? It's pretty graphic. Your whole family, we're getting rid of, we're starting over, we're zeroing Jeroboam's family line out, and we're going to get rid of you like people who get away, like get rid of dung. When you get rid of that, do you even want to know where it goes after that? No, right? You just, as long as it's not in the house anymore or whatever, it's out. Well, I'm sorry? Yes, so he got rid of all that kind of stuff because everybody, yes, in verse 11, anyone belonging in Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dogs will eat. And who dies in the field, the birds of the heaven will eat. And so basically, there's not even going to have a real burial for him. And so this is what is happening. And the child that they're mourning for, he tells her that as soon as you step foot back in your home, the child will die. And he says, because in him something good was found toward the Lord, the God of Israel, and the house of Jeroboam. So all of Israel mourn for him, the son that's going to die. And this is interesting. Because in him something good was found toward the Lord God of Israel and the house of Jeroboam. There's something good about the son of Jeroboam, and God is being merciful for him to die by this, to not see the kind of fate that the others were going to be seeing. So that's what's happening there. And so he talks about what's going on, talks about the sin and how that they'll be scattered. And so verse 17, Jeroboam's wife arises and goes back, and it happened just as was said. And all of Israel buried him and mourned for him, everything that happened according to what Ahijah has said. And then verse 19, we have the rest of the acts of Jeroboam are made, how he made war and how he reigned. Behold, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. He reigned for 22 years and slept with his father, and Nadab, his son, reigned in his place. So now we go back, chapter 20, verse 21, 14, 21. We start looking at history and succession of kings at this point. 14, 21, we're going to start going boom, 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 boom through different kings and their reigns and what they did, good and bad and the ugly of these kings. And so the first three kings of Judah are mentioned here in this first section, 14:21 through 15:24. If you want to read out here, 2 Chronicles chapter 12 deals with Rehoboam. 2 Chronicles chapter 12 verses 1 through 16. Yes, I have it up here. I wasn't sure how detailed I made this. So here's the first three kings of Judah are laid out here. In this next section of Scripture. And so Rehoboam, he isn't exactly really shiny as a king either. Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king. Now, when you see him and he asks for counsel, and there's the older guys that say, hey, you need to listen to the people, you know, lessen the yoke, and then he listens to his friends. When you hear that, how old do you think in your mind? How old do you think he is? Yeah, he's like a teenager, right? I mean, he's not very old. He's in his 20s maybe, you know. He's a millennial for sure, you know. But you don't think about him already being 41 years old. He's old enough to know better. Old enough to know better about how he did these things. So he's 41 when he becomes, and he rules for 17 years. And he rules from Jerusalem. 23 says that he built high places and sacred pillars and asherim on every high hill beneath every green tree or luxuriant tree. So there was no place that hid from his idol worship. So he went down that path of idol worship, and so he did. He was not just idol worship. What does verse 24 bring out that he did in land? The male cult prostitutes. So I mean, it's like really. I mean, he just really fell from the tree as far as his lineage is concerned. He did all according to the abominations of the people that had been dispossessed before him. And so in this text, Chronicles mentions several different things. It mentions the forces that... Did I skip ahead? Yeah, sorry, I skipped ahead here. So anyway, Rehoboam, actually, because of what he's doing, there's a king from Egypt comes up, Shishak, comes up against him in Jerusalem. And the Chronicles actually gives you more details about the forces that came against him and those kind of things. And the prophet, there's another prophet that actually tells him about things that are going to be taking place and why he's doing these things. Why this king is coming up against him. And is actually, these kind of things are actually recorded. This king, Shishak, that came up, these things are actually inscribed on a pillar in a temple in Karnak. And there's actually, he set up a stele, a pillar-type stone monument in Megiddo talking about these events that have actually been found. So archaeology proves that this king existed, and that these events did take place. So I think that's rather awesome. We start putting archaeology next to the Bible and seeing how all those things would take place. But the prophet told them that because of David, that they would not be destroyed. And so they basically, Shishak comes in, takes all the gold, takes all the treasury out of the house, all of the Solomon's treasures taken away. And they actually are kind of subject to Shishak. They're now kind of under his rule. And at that point, there are bronze shields that are placed in the place of what were gold at the time. And so it kind of talks about how everything has just kind of fallen. As far as the high point of the time of Israel, all of that's being has fallen down. And so they are basically no longer at the height of things like Solomon had. And then verse 29, now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam are all that he did are not written in the books of Chronicles. And there was, verse 30, there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continually. And you'll see this phrase over and over again repeated, that there's war between the two. It's not like they just separated and kind of went their own ways and kind of hung out in their own sections of the land. They were still continual friction between the two of them, and all the time of Rehoboam and Jeroboam and some of the other kings as well. And then chapter 15, we have after him, 18th year of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abijam became king over Judah, and he reigned 3 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name is given us there, and he walked in the sins of his father. So if he walked in the sins of his father, he's not, again, not a shining example of who he's supposed to be. 2 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 1 through 2 Chronicles 14, 1 gives us more information about this as well. He committed the sins of his father before him, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God. In verse 4, but for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem to raise up his son after him and establish Jerusalem, because David did what was right in the sight of the Lord and had not turned aside from anything that he commanded all the days of his life, except in the case of Uriah the Hittite. So they do mention that episode in David's life. But it's interesting here, the sins that are kind of overlooked because of who David was and the relationship that he had with them. There is a war that takes place in defeat of Jeroboam's army. Jeroboam comes up against Abijam, and they kill 500,000 men of Jeroboam. And after that, Jeroboam no longer regains the strength that he once had militarily before. And so God did grant them that. And if you want to go and read, we don't have time to go through that. I wanted to, but we do not have time. But 2 Chronicles kind of goes through and talks about how they were trying to follow the right way. He boasted about following the right way, but he didn't really necessarily do that. Verse 8, Abijam dies, okay? And he sleeps with his fathers. And then they buried him, and Asa, his son, became king in his place. And this is chapter 15, verse 9 through verse 24. And that's 2 Chronicles chapter 14, verse 2 through 16, verse 14. So we have this long mention of Asa. Asa actually becomes a relatively good king. So it was in the 20th year of Jeroboam that he became king of Israel and began to reign as king. And he reigned for 41 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was the same mother as before. And Asa did what was right in the sight of the Lord, like his father David. So again, this litmus test with David. It says that he was wholly devoted to the Lord all his days. So he tore down the idols. He tore down this idol that his grandmother had set up and burned it. He tore all these things down, dedicated himself to the Lord, and did these things. But then there was war between Asa and Baasha, the king of Israel, all their days. And so this war, just because the kings changed, doesn't mean that the wars didn't stop. And so it just talks about that. And the Chronicles mentions some of the Asa's battle with Zerai, the Ethiopian, which is not mentioned here. They went up with 480,000 or 580,000 men. They went up against an army of 1 million men and prayed to the Lord God to deliver them. And they killed all those 1 million men during that time when the Ethiopian came up against them. And there's also some other prophecies that are there that we don't have time to get into as far as Asa. But he does all that. And then when the king of Israel begins to make these this fortified city. So Israel is not a really wide city. You have ocean on one side, and what's on the other side of Israel? Like desert, you know, that's where camels play. And so you have this strip that you have to kind of travel up and down. And there are certain places that if you control certain places, then you control travel in that area. And so if anybody played Risk at all? Anybody played Risk? Okay, so it's that kind of situation. So there was, he had this commanding place that was controlling travel. So the king of Israel was controlling travel that was coming in and out of his kingdom. Probably one, because people are leaving by droves. The faithful are leaving the northern Israel. And so he doesn't want that, and also doesn't want people coming in. And so that's a problem for Asa. And so Asa makes a covenant. He buys off a treaty with the king Aram, who lived in Damascus. And so it makes a treaty with him in verse 19. And he goes, and this guy in Damascus fights against Baasha and takes that city back, and takes several cities back. And so the king basically tore down that city, that fortified place, so they no longer had that place. But in the Chronicles, we're told that a prophet was sent to Asa and told him, "Why did you do that? I was with you when you were fighting against a million-man army. And now, when you're fighting against Israel, you made a treaty with somebody else and trusted in somebody else other than me." And so he kind of gets in trouble for doing that, and he ends up dying. So that happens. So, but he, in general, he was a good king in that he went back to the old ways and tore down all the idol worship and that kind of stuff, and went back to following God. And then Jehoshaphat follows in his succeeds him, but we don't get told a lot about that before we start talking about Nadab and the kings of Israel, which we're not going to have time to get through much of this at all. But let's put them up here for you. Is that how far we go? Yes. Okay. So here are the next succession of basically six kings that were given, and we have 5 minutes to go through a few years of history. So we have Nadab, and in general, there are no... How many good kings are in Israel in the northern tribes? Zero. Zero. They set up that system of worship, and whoop. Unless they went back to serving God, they were never going to be able to be a good king. So their system is not based on... Them being a good king wasn't on their, you know, civic works. It was on their devotion to God. That was the measure of a good king. And so Nadab, the son of Jeroboam, became king over Israel the second year of Asa, king of Judah, and he reigned over Israel 2 years, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. He walked in the way of his father. And then Baasha killed him in the third year of Asa, king of Judah, and it came about as soon as he struck down down all the household of Jeroboam, he did not leave any persons alive, which is what was said, right? That all of Jeroboam's lineage was going to be killed. So as soon as this guy became king, that he killed all the lineage of him, just as Ahijah had spoken about that to take place. And then he talks about the rest of the acts of Nadab are mentioned, and all that he did in the book of Chronicles. Then we have this, again, a mention of war with Judah. In the third year of Asa, king of Judah, Baasha, the son of Ajik, became king over Israel at Tirzah and reigned for 24 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord. So Baasha was evil, as we kind of mentioned him earlier, in fighting with Asa. And the word of the Lord came to Jehu, son of Hanan, against Baasha, saying, "Inasmuch as I exalted you from the dust and made you leader over my people, and you have walked in the way of Jeroboam and have made my people Israel to sin, provoking me to anger." He says, "I will make your house like the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat." So his house. So what are we? We're not just changing kings. We're changing whole lineage. So it's not like, hey, you're just not going to be king anymore. Like, you die and all of your household dies because you didn't serve God. Why does that matter? I didn't serve God as a leader, and now all of my household dies. Is there any application to that at all? Do we need to make sure that the example and the things that we're doing are important in portraying and making sure that our children follow the same path? If they had turned and followed God, the outcome of their own family would have been very different. So the same thing happens to his household. They're all killed whenever the next king comes into place. Allah is now the king. Baasha slept with his fathers and was buried in Tirzah, and Allah, his son, became king in his place. But he only ruled for 2 years because of all the evil and everything. He only ruled for 2 years. In the 26th year of Asa, king of Judah, Allah, the son of Baasha, became king over Israel in Tirzah and reigned for 2 years. Zimri, the commander, waited until he was drunk one night. The king was in the tent with one of his servants, basically just hanging out, drinking, and Zimri kind of waited until he was inebriated and came in and just killed him. That's easier, right? Just wait until he can't defend himself. And so when Zimri became king, he destroyed all the house of Asher, which was what was said was going to happen. But you know what? He didn't reign for very long. In verse 15, how long did Zimri reign? 7 days. Missed it by that much, right? I mean, 7 days. He's barely of a blip as far as a king. And because whenever it's told that he killed the king, Omri, who was a commander of the army, is told, and then they start making him king, and Omri comes up and kills Zimri. They lay siege to the house, the king's house, and Zimri sees that, you know, time's up, the gig's up, I'm not getting out of this, and so he burns the house down around him. This is like television, people. It's really dramatic. So he just burns the house down around him because he knows they're going to kill him anyway. And so Omri, then there's a fight for command at this point because some of the other people want to name Tibni, the son of Ginath, to be made king, and there's a fight, and Omri wins, and Omri becomes king. But you know what? He did evil in the sight of the Lord, even more so. Even though he was a good commander, he changed. Omri is the one that moved the capital to Samaria, built the city of Samaria. Archaeologically, that's been proved that he was a commander in that area. Other nations mentioned about his fortitude as a commander. And then his son after him becomes king. And you may have heard of his son, Ahab. Not the guy that fishes for whales. Ahab becomes comes on the scene and is more wicked than anybody has ever been before. And we'll start with chapter 17, talking about the life of Ahab. Thank you very much for your time this evening.